From 89.7 WUWM Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Teich. Today on an all-history edition of the show, we meet a German historian who was imprisoned by the East German secret police in 1981 for trying to escape to the West.
Then John Goethe adds a post-millennium chapter to his landmark book, The Making of Milwaukee.
You've got the Menominee Valley. I was doing a tour a couple of years ago for class of 1955 from Shorewood and Whitefish Bay High Schools. Some of these folks had not been to Milwaukee in 40 years, took them to the valley. They did not recognize the place. They did not know where they were physically.
And progress isn't always linear, and that maxim holds especially true for cats.
They were domesticated. They were raised to the highest of the highs, and they were plunged down to the lowest of the lows.
The history of cats and more on Lake Effect after the news. It's Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Thanks so much for joining us. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Teich. It is an all-history show today, and our first segment was recorded a little over 4,300 miles east of Milwaukee.
Last fall, I was part of a journalist exchange program that was sponsored by the RIAS Berlin Commission. During my time in Germany, I was able to record a number of interviews with journalists and politicians.
However, our first guest is neither a politician nor a journalist. Peter Kuip is a historian, but in 1981, he was a prisoner in a Stasi prison in Dresden. He'd tried to escape to the West and was caught in the attempt.
Today, Kuip lives in Berlin. He's finishing his dissertation, and he gives tours of the former Stasi prison, Berlin Hohenschönhausen. He agreed to share his experiences with me, and we met at the former Checkpoint Charlie, the infamous Cold War boundary between East and West, to talk.
My name is Peter Kuip. I'm a historian. I'm at the moment writing on my master thesis, and I start to write a dissertation in 2019. So you can tell me, Peter.
Peter, thank you so much for doing this.
My pleasure.
The first time I met you, it was because you were giving a tour at a former Stasi prison, because you yourself were a prisoner, even though it wasn't there, it was in Dresden, yeah, where you grew up. Could you tell us about why you were in prison?
Yes. The reason is my parents, I grew up in East Germany in the communist dictatorship. And I remember when I was 16, my parents applied for an exit visa. They wanted to leave the country because my parents actually came from West Germany. And my mother more or less felt imprisoned in East Germany. And she always, you know, considered finding a way to leave the country legally and at least safely. And when I was 16, they applied for this visa, and afterwards I had to leave the school. I was restricted in opportunities. I couldn't take the job I wanted to do. I couldn't even do the sport I wanted to do any longer. So I was like, they treated me like an outcast. And after 6 years waiting for the permission to leave, 6 years, you know, I spent a life between hope, because I always hoped that one day it will work, and disappointment because it never worked. After 6 years, I tried to escape, and my plan was to escape from Hungary to Austria. There was the border between these two countries was the Iron Curtain, and a remarkable thing at this border was the river Danube. And I wanted to swim through the river from Hungary to Austria, and I hoped myself to succeed that way, so that I can get to Austria, and from Austria it would have been easy to move further on to West Germany. But I failed, so the Stasi, I was in the focus of the Stasi already when my parents applied for this exit visa. And they just waited that I leave my parents' house alone, and then they planned to find a reason to put me in prison. So they did in July 1981, when I was on my way to Czechoslovakia. From there, I wanted to go to Hungary, and when I came into Czechoslovakia, they controlled everything. They found the little Pinocchio and they found the compass and, you know, no reasons enough to send me to prison. And they brought me to Dresden, to the Stasi Remand prison, and I spent, almost 3 months in solitary confinement.
It is almost hard for us in the United States to understand that a country would want to keep its people in so badly that they would take a teenager and put him in solitary confinement because he wanted to go somewhere.
Yeah.
How do you explain that to Westerners that come and take your tours? I mean, are they just shocked?
Yeah. First of all, I was a teenager when my parents applied for the exit visa. 6 years later, I was 22. It is difficult to explain. I mean, first of all, you have to know that it was a dictatorship, and in a dictatorship, you have to accept restricted, you know, opportunities to make a living. I mean, it was illegal to leave the country. According to the propaganda, the wall in Berlin and the border between the two German states was a protection measurement to protect us from the class enemy and so on. Of course, the border and the wall was there to, that we can't escape from the country. You know, many East German wanted to escape from the dictatorship, from the fact that you couldn't talk freely, you couldn't criticize the government, you couldn't travel. You couldn't get information from first hand. You just had propaganda newspapers, nothing else. And everybody who was fed up with the situation tried to move to West Germany because it was the thing that West Germany accepted you as a West German citizen. As soon as you arrived West Germany, you were not a refugee or you were not no need to apply for asyl status or something. You were West German citizen, and it was that easy. You just had to make your way across the border. And many people tried this, but again, it was illegal. And the law was that people who mislead the law, that they have to go to prison.
There's a lot of change going on in the reunified Germany, about to celebrate 30 years of reunification.
Yeah.
And there are people in the south who want to, I hear noise about building a new wall, of walling off again. And what does that make you think? You tried so hard to escape. You went to prison to get out.
That's right. Are you talking about America or Germany to build up a new wall?
Germany first and then America.
Yes. Well, it is absolutely not understandable that people, want to build up any sort of wall. It doesn't matter if it's in Europe or in the US, because from my perspective and from my experiences, people will try to cross any kind of border, however it is, built, even if it's built like a fortress. And especially in Germany, with our past, with our history, to suggest, seriously this kind of measurements, this is stupid. And I ask myself, for what? I mean, the world at the moment is a very crazy place. And we in the Western world, we are also responsible for the situation, how it is at the moment. We can't say that something happens, far away and we are completely, we have nothing to do with this. This is a lie. And so we have to accept that people, try to find a place where they can make a better living. And so better we open up our mind and we give our hands to help. And of course, it has to be done in order, in a law order and everything else, of course. But first of all, we have to help and we have responsibility. And for that reason, what does it help? I mean, a wall just... it's not a solution for a problem. It's just an architectural, thing of problem. It shows the problem, but it's not a solution. And for that reason, we need to find another way.
Does it scare you that so many people want to do that kind of wall building again?
I can't think that it scares me. It's more I asked myself, haven't they learned from history? That's my question, and obviously not. So I just asked myself if it's possible to educate people. And again, obviously not. And you know, the protectionism, which is quite common at the moment, it's not helpful. We have to face up the problems in the world, and we have to deal with them. To build a wall and to make us living on an island or on a tower or whatever. Is this the world we want to live in? That's my question.
You give the tours at the former Stasi prison here in Berlin, and is teaching people why you do that? I can't imagine that's easy for you to go in, even though that wasn't your prison. It was one very like the one you were in.
Yes. Well, actually, to make these tours, to talk with people, to inform them about my experiences, to inform them about the, you know, the dictatorship in East Germany and what communism was able to create with people and still creating if you look to North Korea. So it actually sort of helps me. I mean, there are some days, you know, I have my problems and it's not that easy to get through this, but mainly it helps, especially if the visitors are interested in, and if I think they get what it's all about, and they get why we have to care about the democracy in our world. And actually, I appreciate that I have the opportunity to inform people that way. And also, it's sometimes it's not that easy.
I know when I went through it with you, I felt bad energy in that space. It was very hard to describe, but it just felt wrong.
Yes, I share this experience. So yeah, bad energy, the smell, for instance. The smell reminds me pretty much on former East Germany. So you had the smell in every official building, like a civic center or a hospital or school or something like this. So this is pretty much the smell of East Germany. And anything else, the tristness, the you know, the colorless environment, and that's what East Germany looked like. And you know that. The fact that it has been just 28 years or 29 years ago that is, all was still available and working. So yeah, that's right, bad energy, but we can leave this building. We can leave this building and we can leave it behind us. And on the other hand, it's good that it still exists as a memorial, because that let, you know, people feel many things about the dictatorship. And you know, actually communism wanted to be the most social and the most fair society in the world, and then it created something like this just against people who criticized the condition. And many of them, you know, didn't tend to completely roll back the thing. They just wanted to impulse little improvements, and even them disappeared. So everybody who was sort of critical or had other ideas or wanted to apply for changes ended up in such a prison. And that shows, you know, so much about how strange they misleaded the idea of communism.
What do your children think? Do you take them?
I guess so. I mean, it is difficult. I mean, in the memorial, mainly teenagers come, and you know, the age, teenage age is a bit problematic, and not everybody is able to get, you know, what's. But you know, I sometimes have groups with teenagers, and when they arrive, they are quite outrageous and quite. You know, they're making fun and thing. But then they get calm, they calm down, they get more quiet, they start thinking. And sometimes, even if the group is completely outrageous, but then sometimes I really wonder that they, you know, change during the tour. And actually, I never experienced a group which didn't show respect, or which were completely uninterested in everything. So the change, of them is quite remarkable.
And like you said, it's important to tell the younger people what happened.
Yeah, sure. Especially younger people, especially people who, were born in the democracy and they could have the imagination, the idea that democracy is just always available and it's always there. But we, as adults and, educated and informed people, we know that it can change if you look around in the world. So there are many countries. Maybe the most remarkable example is Turkey. I mean, it was a quite liberal democracy, and also the religion was nothing you saw or realized in first place. So Turkey always showed. I had always the impression that's an open country. And what did change? What did change for the free speech, for the free press, and for the people there? And even young people has to know this kind of changes are possible, even in more solid democracies like Italy or in northern countries. There are changes, and if people don't want to risk that the democracy is just leaves or disappears, they have to do something. And this is my appeal to them.
We're sitting here right near Checkpoint Charlie, which was probably the most visible,
the most spot of the division.
Spot of the division, yeah. And you and I both first saw this in 1982 on opposite sides of the wall.
Yes.
What do you think of when you see it now?
Well, it is like on every spot, not just Checkpoint Charlie, also the Brandenburg Gate or the Bahnhof Friedrichstraße or what else, the Bernauer Street. And so, to walk from east to west and from west to east that easy, that it's like a miracle for me still, even after 28 years. And when I get melancholic or emotional in this moment, then I look around and people are literally celebrating things. They make fun and they are in a good mood. I mean, it's their right, and it's actually very good. But I ask myself if they realize, what 28 or 29 years ago at this place has happened. Being at this place meant 29 years ago, they would have shot to death if they would have, made their way to this place. And I look around sometimes, appreciate that young people walking around with their parents or with maybe teachers or groups, obviously they are on the, they research about the past and they are talking about this issue. But on the other hand, many other people, I guess, don't even realize, what happened there. And that sometimes makes me not sad, but I think it was our status quo when we were a teenager. And now, actually, if you look back 29 years ago when the wall came down in Berlin, it all changed from one day to the other. Yesterday, you risked to be shot to death, and the next day, you can walk through. And this is history, and this is, we all, sometimes I feel like a puppy in a play, in a theater play, or in a playground, or whatever. So, but it is how it is. I mean, to be sad, doesn't it up? You have to accept.
Well, I am glad that you and I were able to sit on this side of the wall, or what was the wall, and have this conversation. Peter Koip, it has been such an honor to meet you. Thank you.
Thank you very much. It was a huge pleasure for me. Thanks.
Peter Koip is a German historian and former prisoner of the East German state. He spoke with us at the former Checkpoint Charlie in Berlin. We'll take a quick break and then chat with John Goerde about the most recent chapter of Milwaukee history, literally. That's when Lake Effect continues on Milwaukee's NPR right after this. Lake Effect continues on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Mitch Tye.
And I'm Bonnie North. It is an all-history show today, and for nearly 20 years, one of the go-to contemporary sources on Milwaukee history has been John Goethe's book, The Making of Milwaukee. The book was first published in 1999, and it tells immaculately researched stories from the area's earliest settlement through the cultural, political, and business landscape here at the turn of the century.
But while there were some revisions in subsequent editions, it was not until now that The Making of Milwaukee brought readers fully into the 21st century. The new edition of the book is just out and includes an entirely new chapter that covers Milwaukee history from 2000 to the present. John Goethe joined us ahead of the launch event for the book. Welcome back to the show.
Glad to be back, Mitch.
So, you know, the first thing that jumps out at me in reading the updated part of the book, the latest chapter, the post-millennium chapter, is how odd it feels to be reading this in the past tense.
And I think that's true. I mean, history is walking into this room. So it's very recent. But the difficulty in writing that last chapter was it's very much in your face. So trying to decide, you know, what's going to last.
I wondered about that, right. As a historian, is it more challenging to evaluate the present or the recent past than a distinct period from long ago?
Much more so. I think as I wrote in the book, if you look far enough back, the signposts stand up obligingly. So they almost announce themselves. Eras and epochs, breakdowns and breakthroughs. But for instance, in this last chapter, what impact will Foxconn have? The election had not been held when we were about to go to a press, so Tony Evers is now in the index. And that was a late ad. So these things are so present that any perspective is just about impossible. At the same time, you know, responsibly, you have to say this is part of what's going on in Milwaukee in the 21st century.
It has to be hard to put a deadline on a history book.
So it's sort of ripping history from the headlines. That's kind of what it amounted to.
As the deadline approaches, you just have to hope nothing happens.
Exactly. But you can't slow it down. In the edition two ago, I had thought that things were very stable with John Norquist in office and Tom Amon in office. Go figure. Yeah. So within a year of the time that the second edition came out, pretty much the wheels had kind of gone off the rails.
So. I think you used that term in the book.
I think I may have.
Well, what is that Faulkner line? The past isn't dead. It isn't even past.
Yeah, right.
So as we look at the last 18 years, there are obviously things that if you were writing this book, 50 years from now, mm-hmm. that would have been forgotten about. Do you feel some responsibility to keep that from happening at some level? Is there, as the historian, do you get to decide that this will from here on out be history? I mean, it seems like a flip question, but
in some ways it's an awesome responsibility in some ways. In other ways, it's kind of, who cares? you're sort of looking at one version, one person's version of one community's past. But I do feel a responsibility to, as long as I can, keep this book in print and up to date for whatever generation of readers, who is here. So, yes, this is something that, looking back in 50 years from now, people will make their own judgments about whether I was right or wrong. But I felt a responsibility to keep this current.
Well, remind us when the first edition of this came out.
1999.
So 1999, as and this is the third, is that right?
It's the fourth.
Fourth edition.
Yep.
My math has never been my strongest suit. So when you add the additional chapter, do you ever go back? Are there parts of the first edition that have been relegated to the dust heap, or is the first 9/10 of this book the same as it's always been?
Thankfully, no, Mitch. I had to read obviously every word to take out the anachronisms. Whether they were tribal names or Midwest Express Center, and all the names changed. That's gone through. Miller High Life Theater is the old Milwaukee Theater of the old auditorium. So I had to do all that kind of weeding. But the basic storyline pretty much held up. And there aren't things I look back on and said, boy, because I would have had the chance to kind of retell that story. But the timeline, the through line of the first nine chapters has been fairly consistent. And I was pleased to find that both the writing and the content held up.
Fortunately, there are not too many Solomon Juno revisionists out there.
That's true. Yeah, the Byron Kilburn party is saying, give them a better shake.
Yeah, exactly. Well, so let's talk about this latest chapter. You start in a really interesting place. What inspired you to look at the data center at, what is it, 32nd and Highland as a place to kick off the new millennium?
The book has always begun with a Wednesday at the Potawatomi Casino. And there's so much symbolism there because you're looping back, obviously, to Native times in Milwaukee and the return of Natives to their ancestral ground and the Menominee Valley having been a hugely important source of riches for the ancestral tribes here. And now, under a very different dispensation, it is a critical source of wealth for the current tribe. And again, that line about reclaiming that wealth one gambler at a time. So that was the opening of the book and has been in all the editions. And so here you are, you know, 20 years later, and you've got the Potawatomi tribe is essentially hedging its bets on gaming and opened a $36 million data center in the Concordia neighborhood, which is essentially a hotel for the computers of businesses, nonprofits, large organizations. You know, with apparently data lines that are the size of fire hoses kind of going in there. So it's just a very neat kind of a comeback, internally, almost like music. You kind of come back in music, you sort of go back to the theme. So begin the book on the theme of Native wealth and close the book on the next generations, the coming generations. Capacity to reinvent itself and look ahead to a new technological future. So that was a kind of a neat kind of a connection to make.
Well, and also it kind of speaks as a larger metaphor for the community's reinvention of itself.
Absolutely. And kind of looking back at the kind of the foundation of history, but you're kind of moving forward on a basis of technology, and that has changed everything in terms of how we communicate, how we work, and how we look ahead to our own futures.
The other image that really stayed with me was this imagining of a night flight over Lake Michigan and how the lights, you know, have spread out from Chicago in the recent years.
You know, I've done that actual flight coming from the south. A lot of us have, kind of coming up the center of Lake Michigan when you're coming from the south, Charlotte or Atlanta, someplace down south. And the comparison was within the early days, it would have been the soft incandescent glow that you would barely have seen from cruising altitude. And now you've got these pools of light in Chicago, and that's pretty much continuous up to the state line, and then pools of light in Kenosha, then Racine, then Milwaukee, and the terminal darkness going all the way up into the UP. And the point I was trying to make is that even as we have, you know, the essential story of Milwaukee being its own story, you know, very distinctive, very unique, it's also part of this emerging region that will, in the next generation or two, be one continuous pool of light from South Bend to Madison and up into the Fox Valley. So you have everything taking place in the Milwaukee area has to be seen in the context of this kind of, I think I called it runaway regionalization. And where you see that really, I mean, look at Foxconn and Uline and Amazon, that whole corridor down to I-94, a lot of change going on.
Right, and I think if we looked at the lights from that corridor today, it would be a fairly narrow band extending north from, say, Kenosha to Milwaukee. But I wonder if 5, 6, 10 years from now, that band will have gotten wider and wider.
It'll be wider and longer, and I think you see it especially going west to Madison. Now there are people commuting in both directions, you know, from Jefferson or Lake Mills. And it'll be a longer time coming, but I'll see the band going up to the Fox Valley as well. So certainly a huge change.
The last 18 years in Milwaukee have really represented sort of a sea change in politics as well. You, I think, alluded to this earlier in the interview, but at the dawn of the millennium, it was really, there was a fairly long-held stability in local and regional politics.
Absolutely.
Here.
In 2000, things were pretty much as they had been for some time. 1988 was kind of a watershed election. Dave Schultz becomes kind of the new guy in the county executive seat, and John Norquist as mayor of Milwaukee. So those two were kind of the next generation, but they sort of fell into that long-term pattern of stability, you know, long tenures. Schultz less so, certainly, but Norquist was there for, you know, until 04. So you have, you know, this feeling of longevity, stability. The pension scandal hits, the caucus scandal hits, and the wheels really fall off the bus. And then you have, you know, the rise of Scott Walker as a reformer coming in and kind of riding the pension scandal to his term as county executive for 8 years from 2002 to 2010. And that set the stage for certainly much more happening on the state level. So it was really tumultuous politically and remains so.
Remains so, although you make the point that that Mayor Barrett came into office at a really tumultuous period, but has subsequently been reelected by fairly substantial margins. At some point, you would imagine, whether it's the next election or some election down the road, there's going to be, you know, we're going to return to a time of turnover.
We will, and we will have a black mayor. In the next generation, but certainly probably early in the next generation, we'll have a black mayor because the city's population is around 40% African American. So that's the next kind of change that we'll see.
The other change that has happened at a fairly rapid rate in downtown and spreading a little bit out of downtown is just the physical appearance of the city, whether you're talking about the Menominee Valley or the skyscrapers on the lakefront.
It's been remarkable. I recall a magazine story back in the 80s. I think it was Milwaukee Magazine talking about the now downtown's done. That renovation, you know, it really changed it. No, you have just this remarkable capacity for cities to reinvent themselves, reimagine themselves. And I was surprised to find that since 2005, this is not on the drawing boards. This is projects that are either in the ground or going into the ground. $5 billion of reinvestment, that is unprecedented. We have never had, you know, that level of investment in downtown Milwaukee. And it's not just downtown. You've got the Menominee Valley. Someone I was doing a tour a couple of years ago for class of 1955 from Shorewood and Whitefish Bay High Schools. Some of these folks had not been to Milwaukee in 40 years, took them to the valley. They did not recognize the place. They did not know where they were physically. So that transformation is going on. The Harbor District is, I think, the next Menominee Valley between, you know, downtown and the Bayview neighborhood. You know, that area is just brimming with energy. The area kind of farther north along Commerce Street, Brewers Hill, moving up into Harambe. So a lot of vectors of energy kind of spreading out. So it's been a remarkable transformation.
And interesting, at the dawn of the millennium, the Park East Freeway still existed.
That's right. And that was a lot of, you know, the Park East was a very expensive off-ramp. You know, it took people from the freeway, the 43, into downtown. John Norquist spent a whole lot of political capital having that torn down, and it gave Milwaukee a sizable area of land to develop in the very, very heart of town. That doesn't happen very often in urban America. So what you have there, obviously, is the Fiserv Forum, the entertainment district, hotels, housing. So there's been just, again, a transformation there. And up in the northwest corner, the Pabst redevelopment, Joe Zilber's group has really taken that on. So what had been pretty much a dead corner of downtown is just surging with life.
You say northwest. That's the northwest corner of downtown.
Right.
There is a vast portion of Milwaukee that's still kind of waiting for that.
And it's kind of the downtown area and kind of the adjacent neighborhoods. And at the same time, you know, you don't want to push the Dickensian model of the tale of two cities. But that's going on here as it is going on in Chicago, Cleveland, Pittsburgh, Detroit. You know, it's all around the urban north especially, where you have, as deindustrialization has continued, you have catastrophic unemployment in the near north side especially. So those neighborhoods north of Harambe, Imani, Metcalf Park, the whole area around Lindsay Heights, no, they were really hammered by the Great Recession of 2007-2008. Foreclosures, teardowns. So there's been just the term I think I used was Detroitization, like in the Lindsay area. That population's gone down from 40-something to 5 or 6,000 in the years since 1950 or so. So certainly there has been counterbalancing all the positive developments going on in the central part of the city. There's been continuing misery, continuing distress.
At the same time, as a historian, it must be interesting to look back at pictures from, say, 1950 and see streetcars, and look at pictures mm-hmm. from the end of 2018 and see streetcars.
Yeah, there's kind of a deja vu all over again, kind of going on down there. And the hop, I think certainly the important thing to note there is that it was kind of use it or lose it federal funding. And I think of it as sort of a starter line. Now it's 2.1 miles. So with the quote here, it'll be 2.5 going out to the lake. But I think the real test is how much we get into the habit of the hop and how much impetus there is for expanding that line.
Well, that'll be something for the fifth edition.
You're right.
John Goerda, congratulations on edition number 4, and we'll talk to you again soon.
Hey, thank you, Mitch.
Historian John Goerda is the author of numerous books on Milwaukee, including the latest edition of his book, The Making of Milwaukee. It's just out.
One more break, and then a short history of cats. No, not the musical, the actual creatures themselves. You are listening to Lake Effect on Milwaukee's NPR. Back with more of Lake Effect. I'm Mitch Tite.
And I'm Bonnie North. We are talking about history on today's edition of Lake Effect, but not all history is about human beings. Cats take center stage in our next segment, which, if they could tell you, if they could be bothered to, is only right and appropriate.
Dr. Paul Koudinaris is, among other things, a cat historian. In honor of International Cat Day on August 8th, Koudinaris gave a lecture about the history of American cats at Cafe Lulu. He sat down with Lake Effect's Joy Powers beforehand and talked about our cultural perceptions of cats.
We think of them only in modern terms, and we tend to overlook how nasty humanity was to them at one point in time. You know, we're all familiar that with ancient Egypt being kind of like the zenith of feline culture, but we kind of overlook the fact that for several centuries during the Middle Ages, they were persecuted and not liked, and they were burned in bonfires, and they were considered the consorts of witches and the embodiment of the devil. You know, so it's like they were domesticated. They were raised to the highest of the highs, and they were plunged down to the lowest of the lows. And then very, very slowly, by the end of the 19th century, they finally built themselves up to be companions again. Because if you went back in time to like 1850, they would have been considered, even though they were living in a city environment, they'd be considered no better than like a weasel or a raccoon. In terms of the domestication, you know, I always say that we make a big mistake when we think we domesticated animals. It's a partnership, and it always is. And anyone who doesn't believe me, go out and get yourself a bobcat and give it a try and see what happens. You know, back in the days, humans thought they were so crafty, and they came up with this thing called agriculture back in the Neolithic. And they didn't have the foresight to realize that this was heaven for rats and mice, because all this excess that could be stored was free food for them, and they had no ability to combat them. And slowly, the one specific type of cat, which was the North African wildcat, slowly those guys started to figure it out, and they look a lot like a modern tabby would. And they kind of came along and said, hey, all those mice we want to kill, they're all right here. This is a, let's hang out on the outskirts, you know. And then over time, you know, humanity was afraid of them at first. They didn't like them. It would be about the same as having bobcats hanging out. And over time, they realized we need these guys. And so, like I say, it was a partnership because they got something from us and we got something from them. And we probably needed them more than they needed us at first. When they would kill all those rats, eventually humanity would go out and leave them scraps of food to be like, hey, guys, don't leave. Don't leave because we know what happens when you leave. And eventually, you know, eventually that magic moment occurred somewhere back in the Middle East where some guy stretches out his hand and some cat puts his head up and that first pet is made. But it's a partnership with them, and it always has been. And a lot of people will tell you it's like it's more than just a partnership. My cat's actually in charge.
It's funny because when you go back to, you know, you talked about the changes in how we view cats. When you go back to specifically the plague,
yeah.
in England, you know, they killed all the dogs, they killed all the cats,
yeah.
And it just caused the plague to, you know, bloom because they were no longer killing these rats.
Well, I have a statistic for you, actually, on that. That is nauseating probably for a lot of people to hear. First of all, controlling rats. And originally in Europe, it was the brown rat, which wasn't as bad as the black rat, but the black rat came back with the Crusaders. Controlling rats, in considering, you know, medieval sanitation and the kind of way they were living, a lot of people were living in like what we would consider like a beaver lodge or something practically, that was heaven for rats. And it was hard enough to control them even with a healthy feline population. But once you start not only decimating them but chasing them away from your habitations, those rats are going to breed and breed and breed. Something like a pair of black rats can within 3 years breed something like a million others. And on the average in the Middle Ages, there were 10 rats per household. So humans were outnumbered by rats in their own household. And like I said, it would have been hard enough to control them even with a healthy feline population. Without that, those people were doomed. And they did get their comeuppance for that war against cats. They got their comeuppance by realizing, like I said, go back to the beginning. We needed them at the start more than they needed us, and it turned out we really did still need them at some point in time.
So when did we, specifically here in America, where for a long time cats were, again, not terribly welcome, when did we go from these are street animals, these are unwanted, to let's bring them in?
America has an interesting relationship with cats. I like to say, and this is why the talk I'm doing in Milwaukee is specifically about the history of American cats, because it's a fascinating topic, because there is no country in the world where the history of the people and the history of the cats is so closely tied, so closely unified. You know, America was founded by these outcasts who came from Europe. But they came on those boats with cats because cats were needed to kill rats and mice on those ships. We don't, you know, we look at the Mayflower and all those ships as bringing human colonists, but we don't realize they brought feline colonists too because it was a one-way trip. So those cats also got off those boats at the same time as those people, and they founded their own feline states of America, you know. And Europe was still persecuting cats, but there was something about American ingenuity that was more about like, we want to know what value things have, you know, more than really the spiritual detriment of having a cat around, you know. And so America was more interested in trying to find ways to put them to work. You know, there's this old theory in England that Isaac Newton invented the cat door, as if it takes, you know, a genius in astrophysics in order to figure out a cat door. It's not true. You know who invented it? American farmers. Because they didn't really want them as pets yet, but at the same time, they knew these guys can help us. So they made these little doors so the cats could go in and out. Even wildcats could go in and out and kill rats. America was the first country in the world to write cats into its national budget. In the 19th century, the Treasury Department wrote cats into the budget to protect the mail. The first budget involving cats included $1,000 for the U.S. Postal Service, $100 to New York, $10 to Philadelphia, and so on down the line, depending on the size of the post office. And it doesn't sound like a lot of money, but remember, these cats were supposed to be feeding themselves. But if the cats would kill all those mice, they'd be like, yeah, we want to feed these guys. These are government employees. The United States Army, people don't know this, we think of, you know, war dogs, right? The United States Army had hired cats long before they had hired dogs. The United States Army had hired cats in the 19th century, again, to protect the commissaries. And every commissary had cats. We did not have a dog service in the United States Army until World War I. So the United, like I say, the United States embraced cats more than any other country. They finally really, but they're not really pets. Like I say, they're more like service animals. It's something that comes in the late 19th, early 20th centuries. Interestingly, again, the parallel between American people and American cats, it was in the West where the cats made their name. It wasn't back in the East, because we expect, you know, American culture to flow east to west. A lot of cats had wound up going out west, and people don't realize that a lot of cowboys had cats too, and some of them would even ride with them on their saddle, you know, because they wanted to protect their rations from field mice when they would stay for somewhere for the night, because, you know, this guy's going out for 3 months at a time. He can't afford to lose his rations, so he might bring a cat along with him. And think for a second about, you know, some cowboy, lonesome guy on the trail, all he's got is this cat. You know he's going to become friends with that damn animal because they're good animals and they're nice animals. And so they started becoming accepted more in the West, and then that filters back to the East. And once it starts filtering back to the East, it gets picked up by the avant-garde, you know, the independent thinkers, guys like Mark Twain. He was one of the first great Americans to love cats. The writers all started loving cats. In a way, it was a way to kind of like flaunt social mores and take the anti-pet. I'm going to take the cat instead of a dog. But they'd also found something in them. The Americans, it was the Americans who realized, I think for the first time, something the ancients realized, that a cat is an enigma. And in being an enigma, it can be a muse. And so it was the American literati and all the artists, and these articles would come out in the newspaper that said, you know, it's like, hey, if you want to be a writer, get yourself a cat. And so it was around that time, it was around the late 19th, early 20th centuries, they really start being accepted in American culture. It starts with the aesthetes. It starts with the writers and the painters, and you know how that goes. You know, it's like they're the bearers of culture. So once they start doing it, everybody else starts crashing the party.
So I know that you're researching a book, really, about cats. What are some of the more interesting cats that you've come across as you've been doing the research, specific cats?
Yeah, there's some great ones. America, as I said, really has a great history in cats. In the 1890s, there was a cat in Chicago by the name of Toots Willard. And Toots Willard was the temperance cat. Toots Willard was the cat who saved America from public drunkenness. And Toots Willard was owned by a woman who was very big in the temperance movement, and she used to bring this cat around to temperance meetings. And Toots Willard was this enormous cat, like 30 pounds. So it was kind of like it just worked because of its freak appeal. Like they'd sell pictures of Toots Willard. It was kind of like nowadays if they sent like a 60-pound raccoon to a grammar school to tell kids to stay off of opioids or something. It was just like it had this weird freak appeal. So Toots Willard was this really big deal, and he raised thousands and thousands of dollars for the temperance movement in America. He was like the public face of the temperance movement. Our first celebrity cat was, you know, we think now, oh, well, it's the day of the cats because of the internet, you know. We don't realize how big some of these animals were and how famous they were in their day, because we remember human history and we don't tell it from, you know, the animal's perspective. There was a cat by the name of Kiddo, who was an airship cat, who was super famous because the first dirigible aircraft to ever try to cross the Atlantic crashed. For all the humans, there was humiliation, but it wasn't the cat's fault. So kind of like to put a spin on it, they're like, hey, aviating cat, and everybody went for it. And this cat went on a national tour in 1911. This cat, Kiddo, was making $2,000 a week. In 1911, when money meant something, that's a big deal cat. $2,000 a week in 1911. So we've had our share of really fascinating cats that people have forgotten. Another of America's first famous cats was the Brooklyn Borough Cat, a cat by the name of Jerry Fox, who was famous because he wore spectacles. When his eyes started to go bad, they had fit him with a tiny little pair of glasses and somehow gave him an eye test. So we've had this wonderful history of these very colorful animals. You know, there's something much more to a cat than sitting on a couch if you'll let it be something more.
All right. Well, thank you for sharing so much about cat history, so much that I didn't know. And thanks for joining us here in Milwaukee.
Thank you so much.
Paul Koudenaris is a cat historian. He was in Milwaukee for a talk on the history of American cats in August. He spoke with Lake Effect's Joy Powers then. And that wraps up today's history edition of Lake Effect. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Teich. Tempted to say this show is history for today. Thank you so much for tuning in, and I hope you'll be with us again tomorrow at 10 for another edition of Lake Effect on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.
Fresh Air comes your way next. It's 11 o'clock.